Happy Friday morning, everyone. It's time for another episode of What's Happening QC, the culture guide by Quad Citizens for Quad Citizens, brought to you by Seifert Building Supplies. I'm Mark Zyla. What's happening in Quad Cities? What's happening in Quad Cities? What's happening in Quad Cities? What's happening? What's happening? Davenport and Rock Island, Bettendorf and Molly. Don't forget about East Moline. What's happening? What's happening? August 9th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. is the Figgy's second Saturday this month. Tons of activities, free admission from 10 a.m. to 5. There's art making activities and so much more. And today I have Philip Alejo on the show to talk about the Rivertown Duo's performance that will happen at 2 p.m. this Saturday at the Figgy Art Museum. Thanks for coming on the show today, Philip.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Yeah, no problem. So tell me a little bit about the Rivertown Duo and, kind of how it started and what can people expect from a performance from y'all.
The Rivertown Duo is a unique combination of instruments. I'm a double bass player, and my harp duo partner, Claire Happel Ash, together form Rivertown Duo. And harp and bass is not something that you would expect to see, but it presents us with a lot of possibilities. Mm-hmm. A bass player is more free to play melody. The harp has such beautiful resonant sound, but it also has decay. Mm-hmm. So it gives the bass player a chance to work and play. It works really well out in acoustic spaces like the Figgy in the lobby. I think it's going to be a really beautiful concert there. Mm-hmm. And we have a performance of works by Latin American and Latino composers that we're excited to share. Some of them are premieres. And these are composers who work in traditions that either use the harp or the bass. Mm-hmm. So we think it's going to be a really exciting way to show possibilities of what our instruments can do with really lively, rhythmic, danceable music.
Well, that sounds really awesome. Before I forget, there's also a performance in Macomb, is that right? And tell us what are the details of that performance as
well. Yeah, the next day in Macomb at the Western Illinois Museum. Mm-hmm. We're going to play at 2 p.m. on Sunday, August 10th, and that will also feature one of the composers that we're going to be working with.
Oh, that's great.
And he's going to do a workshop on the Colombian Paraguayan harp.
Okay.
And community members will get to come and learn about that harp, maybe even play it themselves.
Well, that sounds really cool. And folks can find information about that on their website as well?
That's correct.
Okay, awesome. So Figgy's website and the Macomb Art Museum's websites have all the details of those two things. Well, Philip, you have connections here to the Quad Cities, and we're going to dig into that stuff a lot more on the podcast. But tell us what you're up to these days, and what is your connection to the Quad Cities?
Yeah, I'll start with my duo name, Rivertown Duo. Mm-hmm. It pays homage to where I'm from here in the Quad Cities. I was born in Rock Island and went home to Davenport. I have lots of connections on this campus, too, on the Augustana campus. My dad was the volleyball coach here.
Oh, didn't know that.
My mom went to college here, and so did the parents of my duo partner.
Wow.
Both of Claire's parents went to Augustana. We ended up going to graduate school together, and one of the first things that we discovered is that we both grew up in Mississippi River towns. She's from Quincy, and me from up here, and our parents going to school together. We had an instant connection, so when it came to coming up with a name, it seemed like a natural choice for us.
Well, that's awesome. We're going to dig again further into that story here in a few. But again, our details here for the local show, August 9th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. is the Figgy's second Saturdays. And as a part of that, Philip and Claire will be performing the Rivertown Duo at 2 p.m. in the museum lobby. And they will also perform the following day down in Macomb at the Macomb Art Museum. And you can find out more information on both of those websites. More with Philip after this message.
What's Happening, Quad Cities, is made possible by support from Seifert Building Supplies, inviting their homeowners and contractors to take their projects to the next level. Learn more at SeifertLumber.com.
So, Philip, you now live in Arizona. What are you doing there?
I've been on faculty at the University of Arizona. I just finished my 12th year, starting my 13th year. I am the professor of double bass there.
Okay.
And I teach a studio of about 15 bass players.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really exciting to be able to do. It's the career that, honestly, I dreamed about having when I was a kid. And I feel pretty grateful to be there. And Tucson is a really beautiful city to be, especially during the winter. Maybe not so much right now.
Yeah. People like talk about the dry versus wet heat. Do you have a preference? It's just hot either way.
I think today is supposed to be 113. It's just hot either way.
Okay. Whether it's humid or not.
Right. Nevertheless, I'm happy to be there.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your bass studio. I'm just kind of curious, what's the experience for your students? What kind of vibe do you curate there? And what are you all about as a teacher?
Well, it's a state land-grant institution, and one of the missions of having that designation is that you serve the state. So I do my best to open up my studio to any person who really wants to be there and wants to learn the bass. I have students that come in as performance majors who play at a really high level, who have had access to lessons for quite a long time. And I also have students who take their very first lesson on double bass with me once they arrive to the university. Sometimes that person might have played in orchestra for 6 years, but they've just not had the opportunity before to study privately. So it's a huge range. And that's one of the things that I love about my studio. When you go into studio class, you have somebody who is just thinking about some of these foundational principles for the first time, giving feedback to and teaching tips to somebody who's a really experienced player and vice versa. And I think it makes for a unique learning experience that you might not find if you were at a music conservatory where everyone is on a more even playing field.
Well, I have to imagine your administrators are happy with a bass studio of 15. That's pretty awesome.
It's taken some time to get there, to be honest. But yeah, I've worked hard. And I think if you create something where the students are excited to be there, that excitement spreads. And teachers around the state notice that there's activity in a studio and are more likely to send their students to go work with you if they know it's going to be a positive environment.
Well, that's great. Let's take a step back and talk about your journey as a bassist. Again, you're here from the Quad Cities. How did you start and when did you start?
Yeah, I'm so fortunate that in the Quad Cities, there's such great public school education and public school music programs. That's where I got my start. I was in the Davenport Public Schools, and I started playing bass with Chris Kendall.
Awesome.
Who's a longtime member of the Quad City Symphony.
And makes fantastic cookies.
Yes, she does.
Among other things.
Right. And then I just had the opportunity to work with some amazing bassists here in Davenport, too, with Sarah Tinsman, who was my high school teacher at Davenport North, with Linda Gannett, who moved home to play in the Quad City Symphony.
Wow.
And with her sister, Diana Gannett, who is at the University of Iowa, who later became my teacher also at the University of Michigan.
Okay.
And Paul Sharp, who was here to work with Diana, who also taught at Augustana and played in the Quad City Symphony. So I just feel like I ran into a bass family in Davenport. And I didn't know how amazing it was at the time. But now I look back and be like, wow, I had that growing up.
There was a time where the QCSO was performing with flutist Damare McGill, and he came and did a talk for like a Rotary session. And he had just been through like a bunch of schools doing presentations and stuff. And there's a line that he said during that that I feel is really ringing true, both it seems from when you were around and getting started to today, which is, I don't know what you guys are putting in the water here, but keep putting it in the water. And so I just have to, like, you know, my experience has been that there's just so many passionate music teachers that just want people to participate and play. And however that manifests, whether or not it's just a hobby or a passion to someone like you who makes it the center of their life. Talk to me a little bit about your early experiences with the bass. Was this something, you know, when you talk to musicians, there's like seemingly all over a spectrum, but there's the, oh my God, the first time I touched the bass, it was changed my life to, I dabbled. And then as I got better and better, it hooked me. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I have an older sister who's 2 years older, and she started playing viola.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to her concerts, and I think at one of them, I just pointed at the bass and said, I want to play that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty simple start.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I started in the third grade, which was 1 year early, and I got started in lessons right away. And I do think that having lessons is what hooks you.
Right.
I mean, getting to play with your peers is amazing too. I played in Moline Junior Symphony and Quad City Symphony in high school. I played with the Augustana Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
And those things reinforce your passion for what you're doing.
Right.
But in those lessons, it shows you what you're capable of doing and realizes some possibility.
Right. And there's just like a lot more sharing about, you know, the wealth of things in private lessons. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, you know, there's the getting the work done, you know, playing scales, warming up, doing etudes, all those kinds of things. But for me, it's always like the last 5 minutes where you're like, oh, here's this cool thing I saw. Or just like sharing in my case, the horn world with these students.
When I was in junior high, an NEA jazz master bassist named Richard Davis mm-hmm. came to my school. And I think he was sponsored by Quad City Arts.
Yeah.
And he invited me to his bass weekend that he has. It still happens. Mm-hmm. Richard isn't here anymore. But I went up to Madison that weekend, and I continue to go to this day to that weekend.
Wow.
And there are bass players from around the country who show up. Mm-hmm. And that really blew my mind.
Yeah.
How amazing this instrument could be, the many possibilities that you have with this instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And apart from this bass community in Davenport, that is my other bass community that I have, my bass family.
Well, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. You and I met, gosh, it's probably like 15 years ago now, when I first joined the Quad City Symphony as principal horn. You were already in the bass section, I believe. Let's get to there. Where did you go to school? I'm a little bit unfamiliar with the specifics of your career. So where was your undergrad?
I went to school at Oberlin.
Okay.
Yeah, I did a music performance degree, and I wanted to go someplace where I could also do a liberal arts degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied Spanish there.
Oh, cool.
And got to study abroad. And I loved being able to dive into different worlds, and it was before I knew for sure what I wanted to be doing.
Right. And Oberlin is definitely a place where there's much discovery happening.
That's correct.
It was the, I almost went to Oberlin. So we might have been colleagues. When did you go? What years?
I graduated in 2005.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I would have been an upperclassman mm-hmm. by the time you got there. And that it was funny because my two things in high school were horn and baseball. And in the scholarship meeting, they asked if there were any bassoonists, violists, or baseball players in the room, because apparently there was like an email going around that they didn't have enough people to play that particular year. I was like, so I could come to Oberlin and study the horn and be a collegiate baseball player. But anyway, I ended up choosing a different path, mm-hmm. but Oberlin was always a interesting time. Mm-hmm. So where did you go after Oberlin? I think University of Michigan, you mentioned? Was that
eventually
your next
step? I got there. Okay. My next step was at the Yale School of Music,
okay,
which is where I met Claire Happel-Ash, my mm-hmm. duo partner. I started in the middle of the year, and she was in the middle of her second year, I think, when I got
okay.
there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a unique place in that it's only a school for graduate students.
Right.
And it's a really small cohort. So there are about 200 people at the school, and you get to know them really well.
Right.
And they continue to be really valuable professional colleagues of yours once you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's awesome. And then University of Michigan after that?
And then I went to the University of Michigan, in part so that I could work with Diana Gannon again. Mm-hmm. It's unusual, I think, that someone goes and works with their high school teacher.
Right.
But I always felt when I was at the University of Iowa in high school working with Diana that I wasn't fully ready for all that she had to offer.
Right.
And it was a time for me to come and, you know, realize the things that I might not have been able to do 100%. In high school then.
Right. And I think, at least with my experience in grad school, is like you get to this point where your development as a player shifts a lot more on you as an individual. You have your routines, you have the things that you feel build your skills. And so lessons almost become this like interaction of like, here's what I'm trying to do, here's the way I'm approaching it, and here's what, you know, the effect that I'm getting, you know, sharing thoughts on how to get to that.
That's very true. And I'm really grateful to Diana because I think she saw that I could understand her beginning pedagogy since I went through it as a young player.
Right.
But then also the way that she worked with more advanced students. So after graduating, she went on sabbatical and extended me the opportunity to teach the Michigan Bass Studio.
Wow.
Which at the time had 20 bass players. Ooh. So I'd never really had teaching experience until that moment, and it was
20 hours a week
being thrown into the deep end.
Right.
I realized that it was something that I really enjoyed and wanted to continue doing.
Well, that's awesome. Let's talk a little bit more about the Rivertown Duo. So you and Claire met at Yale. Did you play together at that point, or was this something that you stayed in touch and then decided that, hey, we should do this duo?
We never played chamber music at Yale.
Okay.
We knew one another from like my very first weeks there.
Mm-hmm.
There were only two studios in the basement of Lee Hall where the bass studio was, and it was the harp studio and the bass studio.
Yep.
So the harpists and the bass players were the odd ones out there.
Right.
After graduation, Claire moved to Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and I ended up in Chicago eventually, too. I was playing in the Civic Orchestra of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and that's when we played a recital for the first time together.
Cool. What was on that recital?
There's not a whole lot of music, as you can imagine, for the double bass and harp,
mm-hmm.
But there are some pieces, including by Jean Francais.
Okay.
There's a Baroque inspired mm-hmm. piece.
Cool.
And there is another bassist from the Louisiana Philharmonic named David Anderson, who's the bass player, and I believe his wife is a harpist.
Oh, cool.
And he's written original works.
Mm-hmm.
So those were two central pieces, and then we would take pieces and transcribe them.
Nice.
Or arrange them for our instrumentation.
That's really cool. Let's talk about the composers that you guys have worked with, because, you know, you have a couple premieres coming up, and you shared with me a recording that you guys have done, and I imagine there's probably some original works for you guys on that as well. What do you guys look for when you're looking to partner with a composer? Tell us about what that environment is like.
Our first commissioning project that we did basically started when we began playing together.
Mm-hmm.
And we had it in mind to commission a classmate of ours who we really loved at school named Caroline Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
Caroline Shaw has gone on to do incredible things. She's a Grammy winner, a Pulitzer winner,
wow,
and more.
Mm-hmm.
When we commissioned Caroline, Caroline told us it was the first time that she'd ever been paid for a commission.
Wow. And I'm sure that what you paid her is pales in comparison to what she demands today.
I think we got the friend discount.
Yeah, you got it on the ground floor.
For our first album, it did start that way. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a lot of experience commissioning or in collecting the funds needed for bigger commissions. So we started by asking people that we admired, that were friends, that we had connections with.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really helpful to get the project going.
Mm-hmm.
We have an album called For Claire and Philip. That's the piece title for Caroline's piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it has other American composers who all wrote unique works for us. some of them are bass players, some of them are harpists. Mm-hmm. I think there's only one composer, Steve Taylor, who's a composer at the University of Illinois.
Wonderful man, who's an ex-horn player as well. Because I went to University of Illinois.
Yeah, and awesome. He's the only non-harpist or non-bassist.
Who's written for you.
Who's written for us on that album.
I enjoyed doing, I was in New Music Ensemble at U of I, and he was the director of that, and always just such a fun and nice man. So,
and I got to spend time with him this summer, too, in
that's
Michigan.
Great. Yeah. That's so cool. Let's talk a little bit about what your life is outside of music. I always like to just give a full picture of what human beings are, and especially with classical musicians, folks think that we just live in practice rooms, which is not entirely untrue, but I do think that we all try to do some different things. What are you into aside from your career in music?
Well, I'm just coming back from having spent the last 7 weeks in Northern Michigan. Mm-hmm. I go to a music festival called the Bayview Music Festival.
Oh, cool.
And I really love it. I take a student with and work with a bass player up there. I play concerts on Sundays and some Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. And that is work and also fun. But I also take a lot of time for myself in the summer. Mm-hmm. I go out and ride my bicycle. Okay. I swim in Lake Michigan most days. I get to go to the gym. I get to hike on the North Country Trail. I get to spend time with family and mm-hmm. eat good foods. And basically, it's what restores me to be able to have the energy to go back and
right.
and take on the coming year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think as a musician, if I don't take care of myself both physically and mentally, the demands of the career can wear you down.
Yeah.
So I need that. And I want to approach my music making from the most positive, most healthy aspects. So I have to do things away from my instrument to do that.
Absolutely. I find that, with my students, that there's this like time where, you know, the lessons are good, 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 good. And then it's like I start to get like distracted or like, and I need just some space so that I can provide the focus and energy needed for lessons because, you know, week in and week out, especially when, you know, the development of a musician is not linear. It's not always going up. And so I don't know about you, but as a teacher, I'm constantly thinking about my students and where they are on that. And sometimes I get frustrated like they do when the plateaus come and, you know, rest and stepping away is always, I think, a good thing to start with.
Yeah. At this music festival, I get to do a daily warm-up and or lesson with my student who comes.
Yeah.
So in 1 week, they get about the same amount of hours of lesson or contact that they do in a semester right. at the university. Mm-hmm. So you can take time to really slow down,
right.
to examine something, to not be in a hurry. Mm-hmm. During the year, it's really easy to be like, I have to get through this, I have to get through that. Right. And music making doesn't always work like that. Some concepts come quickly, some are...
take a long
time. And for the long haul.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's still things on your list of things in your own playing. You're like, I got to get this going.
I know. Diana used to have a poster in her room that said things of quality take time.
Right.
And I do have to remind myself of that sometimes because we get antsy or greedy about the kind of progress that we want to make and we have to slow ourselves down.
Yeah, so I'll say that my ability to play fast notes, double tongued is, I'm just working on quality. It's taken my whole life, but I'll keep working on that. Mm-hmm. It takes time. Well, Philip, it's been awesome to reconnect with you today and hear about what you're up to and hear about your performances this weekend. Thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. You can hear all of my conversations on What's Happening QC, both on the WVIK website, WVIK.org. I'd really appreciate it if you subscribed on your podcast player of choice. And thank you again for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Thank you for listening to What's Happening QC. Our theme music is by Centaur Noir and Del Rockford. WHQC is produced by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.